Welcome to Pat's Labor, a podcast about the anime Pat Labor and Pat's Labor to learn about labor history through the prism of Pat Labor. My name is Tucson Egan.
Tucson, that was your best work yet. I'm Patrick Gill.
Thank you.
And I am merely Clayton Ashley.
That was good. That was a great read. That was like a sort of very practiced, calm read of that intro where it didn't feel like there was any tension at all about not getting it right. And you had sort of gotten to the point where you're just taking your time with it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Totally. It was almost like a public radio.
Yeah. In another life, I would have probably been in public radio. In another life, I would have probably pursued that. And maybe one day I may pursue that. Maybe I'll have a pirate radio station where I just play whatever music I want.
There's something so attractive about the idea of like radio, right? Mm-hmm. Just like
live radio, person talking in that moment.
And
the number of decades of American history where you just had guys whose job was like, I'm just going to sit in this room for 6 hours and yap.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be particularly entertaining, but it's going to be, it's what you got. So you got to deal with it.
It's the precursor to, podcasts.
That's right.
That's right.
Except there were only like three of them and not 3 billion.
Yeah. Return. We need to go back. But of course we have to keep this podcast because it's important.
Except this one.
Except
this very specific niche anime podcast.
Absolutely. People need to know their labor history and their Pat Labor.
And what a Pat Labor it was.
Right. We already kind of briefly talked about it, but like, should we do this part one, part two? Should we do like one episode?
Yeah.
We would have been like going 3 hours if we tried to do two episodes.
Oh, yeah.
Two episodes together, I feel like.
There's plenty here to talk about. There's plenty here to talk about.
This is where shit gets real. This was, what is the name of this episode? I've already forgotten.
This is SV2's Longest Day, part one.
So SV2, again, that is Special Vehicles Unit 2. That is the sort of ragtag unit of police mech pilots we've been following since the beginning of the series. So this is their longest day, part one.
Yes.
And I think, is it safe to say that because we mentioned this last time, how we're moving forward in time. It's definitely winter.
Yes.
But is it like specifically holidays, like Christmas holidays? Because that's the other thing.
It's like winter holiday. They showed a shot of the calendar at the very beginning of this episode. And I just like went back and checked my notes. It looks like it's somewhere around like December. It's like that's because it is snowing at that time. But like the first episode, again, it took place around like March of that year. So it's like this is literally December, circa December 1998 going into 1999. And so it's been so rewarding and interesting to watch this series, to watch this particular OVA front to back. Because you see all these different mentions about the progression of not only the Babylon Project, but also sort of how just the entire Special Vehicles Unit, both 1 and 2, have grown over the course of this series. Like, I really love that, yeah.
And to recap for people who might not remember, the Babylon Project is a massive civic project designed to save Japan from rising sea water levels. So it's a series of pumps and levees and massive structures out in the sea that will keep the sea at bay and then eventually be used to reclaim land that has already been lost to the rising sea levels.
Literally built in
ecological
Tokyo
impacts
Bay.
Be damned.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Yeah.
The I was also going to say the other thing that's interesting about the fact that this series has these like kind of time jumps or just time passes is that I'm glad I also didn't watch this as like a binge, but I'm actually giving each episode time to stand on its own this way.
Absolutely.
Because they feel designed to that, even though it is like a, you know, a short series in OVA. They are each standing on their own very much. And even this one that is literally a part one still feels very much its own piece. I think that's also cool.
We can get into the plot recap of this episode, but like looking at the notes I took of it, this episode is structured so unbelievably well.
Yes.
Like, it reminds me of, I don't know. It reminds me of, I mean, I guess it feels sort of like the first half of a short film or, you know, sort of standalone. I don't know. I remember watching the first episode of Westworld and being like, oh man, the structure here is so fun. Like they've thought about how the details are going to be dripped out to you bit over bit over the story that creates sort of a satisfying narrative arc, satisfying little mystery. And then everything after that, I was like, I don't fucking care anymore. This is so boring.
The pilot of that show, not to get on the tangent of this, but it's like the pilot of that show is really, really good because the way that it's edited together, it only becomes apparent at, I believe, the end of that episode that there are two different timelines. Like they split them in half. And so the way that it's structured up until like the last scene, you'd think that these two timelines were actually converged into one and they were all happening like simultaneously, like contemporaneously with one another. And just like, no, that's not the case at all. It was like, so I do enjoy, there are things that I do enjoy about Westworld and there are a lot of things I don't enjoy about Westworld. And I will take the good with the bad. I've gotten flack for some shit that I wrote in the past about Westworld. And I'm just like, I get it. But also like, come on. It's like,
yeah. So this one, sort of has two threads as well, except instead of two different sort of timelines, it's these sort of concurrent threads of boredom and growing suspicion right from the get-go of the episode. They establish that everybody's on break and a lot of them don't know what to do with that downtime. So the episode opens up with Godot, sort of sleepy-eyed, apparently lazy CO of the SV2 unit showing up at headquarters, and he's immediately reprimanded by Nagumo, who is there holding down the fort because it's his day off. Yeah. But he's bored and he doesn't have anything to do, and he just wants to be. At this moment, his excuse is, "I'm just bored. I need something to do."
That's what he says at the outset, but it's very it's very interesting. The motivations as to why he is there. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the next immediate thing that we get that establishes the other thread that's going to run through this episode is we get a shot of an ominous figure who the moment you look at him, you're like, that's a Fed. That's a G-man. Mm-hmm. There is a man in a coat with sunglasses outside the HQ, just sort of staring at the HQ from a great distance.
That's a Death Eater.
There's also this thing about it where immediately the tone of this one feels different. It's like dreary. Like the boredom is not new to this series at all, but this like sense of dread is that kind of like immediately starts with this one, which is interesting.
The sky is like overcast and it's all sort of like very, that's, I feel like that really like establishes the whole mood of it. Usually it's boring, but it's sunny, but now it's boring but also dreary, and I feel like that goes a long way to like sort of sell the tone of that.
I was going to say, for the rest of the SV2 crew, the energy to me really feels like college winter break when you are going home, but you're not really connected with your high school friends anymore and you're away from your college friends, so it's like, yes, I'm home, yes, I'm not at work, but I just feel lost and weird right now. And that's what you see with a lot of the pilots and
perfect description crew.
Because they all kind of are weirdos and they actually found out they function better together. The thing I really love is the next scene, because I was wondering how much backstory we'd get here with Azuma. And immediately we're at a factory that's building laborers. And it's just like, I wonder if this is, it's Azuma's dad's factory. Like literally he's there because, again, he has nothing else to do. He's not even there to hang out with his dad. He actually just knows some of the, he's got his guy there at the factory who still likes him. And they obviously have a rapport. And I just like how quickly that's just like, this guy, they go back way far. You don't really know anything more than that. The other thing I noticed immediately is Zuma's got a really sick Letterman jacket.
Good news.
Good news stadium jumper on, looking like an absolute pimp. Also, great episode for Asuma Shinohara, who is one of the pilots of SV2 and the son of Shinohara Heavy Industries CEO. Great episode for him being an absolute shit.
Pretty much.
They really lean into it in this episode of like, he is kind of the protagonist, but nobody writing this show thinks he's not a piece of shit.
And just like, his arc is growing up, and he's got a long way to go in order to get there. And it's like, you can kind of, I've never met his dad. We've never seen his dad, but maybe his dad, his dad may be an asshole, but also maybe he might have a point.
Okay. I'll come back to that, 'cause I have a theory, but, yeah. Is he a fail son?
I don't know what he failed. I'm trying to figure out what exactly did he fail at. And it's like, the origin point of like how Azuma, we know that Azuma's dad made him join the SV2 and said, maybe it's because he needed to get work experience or something like that. But other than that, it's kind of like a big hanging question mark, at least from what I remember, as to what is the impetus of like why here and why this kid and what happened between this kid and his dad.
Because they establish they're not on speaking terms.
Oh, no.
He has no place to go, and he still will not go to his dad to like sleep on the couch or something. And even though his dad is like seemingly rich, I mean, he's the owner of a factory. I'm assuming this guy comes from a different class than a lot of the other people on his team. But when I think about like, is he a fail son? I guess the question there is like, does that mean he failed his dad? Cause it seems like in some way he failed his father, but does he consider himself a failure? I don't know.
I think I'm not sure where they're going necessarily with stuff, but I do think there's a lot of things that could be going on there. Mm-hmm. One of the things that pops into mind is like a less psychosexual version of Shinji and his dad.
Yeah,
you know, the sort of get in the mech thing, in that his son in this case is a sort of useful pawn to put within this police system that he wants to sell stuff to.
That's an interesting theory. I thought it was when you said get in the robot, I thought you were about to say get in the power suit and become the heir apparent to Shinohara Heavy Industries. Like maybe that's that sort of thing. Like he wanted to groom his son to take on the family business, and maybe for whatever reason, like Asuma either like rebuffs that or is just not in a place right now to be able to do that. Maybe it's less Evangelion and more Succession, if you get what I'm saying, yeah. Right? Like maybe it's like that, yeah.
Right. The one thing that we know is that him joining the SV2 isn't an act of rebellion necessarily, because it's a thing he was made to do, right? Mm-hmm.
Right. So, yeah. And that is a different. That feels a little different from some of these sort of fail son situations. It's
right.
Not an act of rebellion.
Yeah, this isn't the son of some insane Lockheed Martin executive creating a funny T-shirt business. This is he was sent to military school.
Yeah.
Speaking of the military.
Yep.
The other interesting thing he discovers in that factory, looking over the new plans for Shinohara Heavy Industries' next latest. Labor.
Yeah.
I was almost going to call it a bot. I realize I really can't on this show. Very specific thing.
Yeah.
So the thing about it is it's based on like he basically implies like, oh, you learned a lot from the Pat Labors that we've been using in the security force. And this thing though, wow, it's got like heavy weapons, room for two pilots. It is a military machine, and they make it clear how that is fundamentally a different thing than even a police labor. Also, surprisingly, not really done yet. Like, this is a new market.
Yeah, they mentioned that. It's like the, I can't remember the name of the mechanic who works at Shinohara Industries, but he's like Asuma's buddy, but he specifically said, since the first construction phase of the Babylon project has been completed, and like, the work from private firms has dried up, now Shinohara is like moving into the military market. So it's like all that stuff that was intended originally for construction and then moved into law enforcement sort of slash like construction. Now it's moving principally that it's from construction to law enforcement to now full on military hardware. We are building mechs. We're building tank mechs. We're building labor mechs.
Small aside.
Like, yeah.
Small aside, but I was thinking because the intro always says like labors were used in everything. And I am kind of waiting to see, aside from construction, what they meant by everything.
I think this is,
But yes, to your point, it seems mostly like construction, law enforcement. And now this is like, well, we got to sell to somebody else. And boy, is there a lot of money in the military.
Right. And which military? I'm just like, this is interesting. Like,
a little vague about that. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So Shinohara has his moment where he discovers that they're up to some no goodness over at Shinohara Heavy Industries, but he's Shinohara, so he doesn't really connect any dots or think much of it.
Doesn't give a shit.
Yeah. He kind of talks like it's like, oh man, this is a great move. He'll sell lots of these. Like,
yeah. Anyway, I'm gonna leave. Yeah. Bye.
Then Shinohara is sort of jumping around his other crewmates looking for a place to hang out during this time off. He drops by with the unit's resident wife guy, and we have some funny wife guy hijinks.
Shinchi.
But he ends up...
Well, we meet the wife. I think we meet the wife.
We finally meet the wife, yeah.
And she's great. Very nice, but does not like the fact that she has company unannounced.
Yeah.
Like,
right, she wants her hubby all to herself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But Shinohara ends up at the residence of one Kanuka Clancy.
Wait, I have to mention
Japanese
one
American. Go ahead, yes.
One last thing. When he left Shinchi's apartment, and the last thing, like, Shinchi basically pushes him out of the apartment when Asuma, like, catches on to the fact, oh, wait, I'm imposing. I should leave. And he says, you may think I'm pathetic now, but you'll understand someday. You'll see. And I'm like, dude, I get it. Like, I'm married. I get it. Like, it's just like, look, there have been times I've been playing the Forever Winner. I look over to the doorway, like, where my wife is standing and just looks at me. I'm like, well, I guess I gotta go to a checkpoint or get out of this game because it's time to stop playing. Like, it's just what it is.
And I also really liked when Azuma kind of like senses, he's not actually welcome here. He just goes, I just remembered a place I need to go. I'll be going now.
It's like, oh, oh, wow, really? Okay.
Yeah, so he ends up over at the residence of Kanuka Clancy, the Japanese-American transfer from NYPD, and she says that she is going to be going back to the United States soon. And this is where we get another sort of intersection of these threads of this growing military dread and this listless Christmas holiday. Mm-hmm. And they're sitting on the couch watching TV.
Yes.
And they see the news about the Japanese Self-Defense Force participating in LIMPAC, which is joint maneuvers between the U.S. and Japanese military. It's a huge portion of the Japanese Self-Defense Force is off doing these naval maneuvers together away from Japan. And there's what I read as a gag here, which maybe it wasn't intended as a gag. It was very funny. So you have the two of them sitting on the couch watching this news, and you hear the narration of what's going on, and you sort of see a zoom in on Shinohara's face, and it's like, oh, is he putting pieces together? And he goes, wait a minute. How come you're just hanging out here? Don't you have stuff to do?
He is so dense. He is so completely oblivious. He literally saw his father's blueprints for a military machine. He saw this on the television. Look, I'm just looking to vibe this Christmas. I don't give a shit about anything. I am off the clock.
Yeah, it's he's just interested in critiquing Kanuka's Christmas holiday plans.
Yeah.
It's almost like, you know, maybe getting more into Pat Labor, this will be a thing that reveals itself. But thinking about the satire of Mecha stuff, he is this sort of like, he's oblivious. He was not forced to do this and doesn't want to, but it's just kind of like meh about everything. It's just like, whatever.
This is the reason like, why your ass is in the SV2 to begin with, because you're meh about everything. Like, what is there? Like, lock in, Asuma. Lock in.
You don't hate being here, but it's not like you're Noah and you're just so into it and so into labors. It's just like, whatever, you know, for the most part here, he is just oblivious and looking for a place to crash.
Can we mention how Kanuka greets Asuma when he comes over? He comes to the door. There's another fish-eyed lens shot as well, too, because obviously Mamoru Oshii has to fit in one, every so often. And it's like, Kanuka unlocks her door or whatever, and he holds up a rose, and he's like, this is a stick-up. And Kanuka has got her pistol out and is like aimed down at this dude. It's like, oh, thank you for the flower, but don't try that shit again. I'm just like, yo, you will never catch Kanuka slipping. She's always got that thing on her.
Do not mess with her.
Be careful with pranks. Those could be dangerous to your health.
Yeah, that's what it is.
really specifically, I don't know how intentional this is, but maybe notice that the gun that she is using is a Colt 1911, which is not a Japanese gun.
It's American.
Yes. And it was specifically when MacArthur dictated that Japanese police were going to start carrying guns. The Colt 1911 was one of them initially, but it was quickly replaced by much smaller automatic pistols and those like sort of snub-nosed 38 revolvers because the Colt 1911 was too big for a lot of the officers, specifically a lot of the female officers felt like they couldn't, because there were female officers, felt like they couldn't handle the 1911 quite as well.
That's a fascinating, like, that's a fascinating fact and such such a interesting way of characterizing Kanuka, because one, she is American. She's half Japanese, half an American. I think she was born in Hawaii, but like, she's always got a gun on her and just like, no, I'm not just some dainty flower. Like, no, I have a gun and I have like a gun that people thought was too much for like a female officer. And it's just like, no, don't mess with me. I love that.
Oh yeah. That's I think was the other thing is that the Colt shot 45 rounds. So it kicked like a mule.
Jeez.
Yeah. Anyways. So Shinohara misses another cue in that, LIMPAC, this massive military exercise is going on. And he gets bored and drifts on.
There was something about it that was very funny to me and kind of like in retrospect, but part of the broadcast is just the news broadcaster just starts listing every like thing that's participating in the big game. So it's like 8 destroyers, 3 aircraft carriers, 9 submarines, which is funny both for it's making it like boring, but it's also like, this is like a lot of information about military tactics they're just broadcasting on TV.
Right. You shouldn't, you probably shouldn't be doing that. So like Asuma moves on, and I just want to point out this beautiful shot where he's just like standing on an overpass over a
gorgeous
highway, and it's just like you don't see cars, you just see light trails, and I'm like, oh, that's so good. I love that. It's just like so gorgeous. It's such a great shot.
It's a thing here, we touched on this in a previous episode a little bit about how it can be, I'd say minimalist, not necessarily like cheap, but it's also in the way we felt like this episode was like a little bit, it was like so tightly written. Mm-hmm. It's cinematic, I think, in a very like general sense. Like you can imagine the like camera shot that would be used to create that. You can imagine how that is using light to make that scene interesting. And it's just cool that they are confident enough to make something like that, that is simple on its face, but is just gorgeous really sets the tone.
Yeah. So meanwhile, Noah is at home being criticized by her father, who thinks that she should stop being a mech pilot police officer and get married and, you know, fall into a more traditional female role.
What a tiresome bore.
Yep.
Yes.
And she has to defend it. The one thing I remember her saying specifically when he's talking about, why are you into robots so much? And she's like, it's a labor, not a robot.
Uh-huh. And his name is Alphonse.
Yes. And so she gets a call from our friend Shinohara, who is bored and wants to hang out. And this was another one of my favorite Shinohara moments of this episode, where he finds out where she lives and immediately begins criticizing her for where she lives.
Yeah, also got himself invited.
Right.
Yes.
And then is like, by the way, where do you live? And it's like, Hokkaido. Yeah.
Lord.
Which that's the separate island to the north, right?
Yeah, I think so.
The point is it's far away, and he's saying, why do you live in Hokkaido?
Yeah, it's like, why? Like, what kind of question is that? I'm just like, you literally just got invited to come visit. Shouldn't you know where your friend lives before you ask to go over there? My goodness.
And another great detail in this scene is there's a moment where he can't hear her on the phone, and it's because he is calling from an underpass, and in the overpass, a column of tanks and military hardware is rolling by.
He is so dense.
And it's like, I'll admit that at this point, I'm still kind of like, where is this going?
Mm-hmm.
I did just make the assumption. It's like, oh yeah, it's the games or the tactic games. Like that's just moving them around. I don't think that's actually what this is about yet, but it's an interesting detail. And it's not the only thing that is kind of going on here. So before he like meets up with Noah, we have what I thought was the big budget sequence in this episode. It's not the only one, though. It's just really cool.
Yeah.
So it starts off, we're on like a highway. where somebody's driving a big truck, and it's clearly a labor transport truck because we've encountered these quite a few times in the show already.
Right.
And the guy who's driving it, you know, he looks like a government dude. He's got dark glasses. And he's just encountering some like sort of traffic cops getting by a checkpoint. And they're just like, oh, by the way, you know, if that's a labor transport, you got to show us the proper ID. And this is the point where it all seems kind of a little shifty and suspicious. And at this point where the cops start insisting, no, you really do have to show us the labor transport information you have, or we got to take a look. And then at that point, the dude just like kicks the door open into the cop's face and they just drive off. Mm-hmm. And then incredibly sick jazz flute music plays.
Yep.
So good.
It's so good.
Yeah.
I just had to note that more than anything else. I mean, the scene is like animated gorgeously, but man, did I love that jazz flute. And cops still are immediately going in pursuit because they just blasted through a checkpoint. But then whatever's in the back of this truck, they like awaken it. They get some like comms, the people who are robbing or driving away. We don't know it's a robbery yet. They're driving away and they're talking to someone who's like, just take care of it. Like, so we know that they have some direction, but what they do to take care of the cops is they activate the labor in the back, and it's a military labor, the one we learned about. And it just uses its Gatling gun, and it just shreds the cop cars. They do not stand a chance. They all are destroyed.
Just chews through the highway, and then you see on the back of it, like, no, this is like a special ground. Like, this is the Japanese self-defense force. I'm like, oh.
Yeah, it says right on there.
Yeah, it just says that right on there. Like, man, so terrifying.
And I think that was really good for, like, emphasizing the military labor is a whole different ballgame.
Yeah.
Like, this is not the same thing as even, like, not clearly not the same thing as police cars, but, like, this is a different beast even from what we've seen as of Pat Labor's.
They clearly don't care about budget when it comes to bullet budget, like, because they're just spraying and praying. Like, they got bullets to spare. Like,
in less than a second, this thing fires more bullets than are fired in the entire series up till this point.
Right? Yes.
Like, damn.
They don't have the conversation like, well, I need to authorize you to fire that round before you can. It's just like, yeah, you can go ahead and shoot. And it's just.
Yeah.
So that happens. And then that just happened.
I feel like Oda went into the wrong branch of like, right? Yeah, just man. Like, look, man, you really chose the wrong one. If you wanted,
he would have found a way to fuck it up. Honestly, he would have.
Yeah. Absolutely, he would have. Absolutely, yeah.
And I think he's actually better than that. I'm hoping.
I hope so. Yeah.
The thing though also about this is like I mentioned that like this felt a little earlier than normal in these episodes. There was something about this happening like. I don't even think this was like midway through the episode. So it also, I feel like ratcheted up the intensity. Now everything that's going on feels much more suspicious.
Mm-hmm. Right. And our next scene is sort of back to more of that sort of slice of life, hurry up and wait stuff. It's Shinohara waiting at a ramen restaurant, being an absolute dick to the service worker there.
Mm-hmm.
Was really cool. I really like, even though he just says like a few things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then another one of these G-men shows up in the black coat, very sort of chiseled face, really pronounced features, but still sort of a gray man.
Sits down next to him. Does not get scallions with his noodles?
Yeah.
No scallions with his noodles.
Yeah.
Sits down, eats some ramen. Shinohara glances at him like, something interesting about this guy.
Yeah.
And then Noah shows up to pick him up, and they're out of there.
Also, the ramen shop guy is like, how much do I owe you? It's like, it's on the house. I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. That's really cool of you. Like,
that's the dream, man. Yeah. I want to go to a ramen shop where the guy says that's on the house, man.
It's like, man. Ramen. Yeah.
I don't know. I may be reaching here, but I think there's also some implication about rural life being a little different than the city life. Because like the one thing I'm thinking about is that like we haven't been often outside of the city in the show, but we're clearly in Hokkaido once Noah walks in. But we're not staying with the team here. We're going back to Goto.
Yes.
And head of SMU.
Nagumo.
Yeah.
And they are still just kind of like hanging out. You know, he's still not gone on vacation. And they notice something. There's like a guy watching them.
Yes.
Out of the car.
They have scouted the G-Man from the beginning of the episode.
And at this point now that Goto, they know they're using binoculars to look. But while he's looking, the guy in the car is also looking. They notice each other and then the G-Men drive off.
Yeah.
So this is the thing. It seems like this is the show. This episode is the one where you, if I don't already love Goto.
Yeah. Goto the goat. Like this dude, you cannot underestimate this dude. He's got plans within plans. I don't know what's going on with him, but he's always on one.
And it's very much like in direct, like a very good contrast with Azuma, who has no idea what's going on.
Right.
But he is plugged. He's aware that this is a bad sign for various reasons. And so he decides to go to the mechanics who are taking this vacation opportunity to do a complete like teardown and repair of the three units that they have. And he's like, I need one. I need to take one, get one ready on a truck. Don't put this like in the official books. We're just going to take this ourselves.
Just send it to the manufacturer. Yeah.
And who are our two mechanics?
It's Shiba and Sakaki. And Shiba's like the second in command chief mechanic. Yeah.
And he's upset. He hates this. This is our opportunity to repair them. Why in the world would you do this? What could you possibly need? We're supposed to be on vacation. And without saying almost anything, is also gets it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. I just have a hunch. And they just like share a glance for one another and be like, yeah, okay, I'll let you do that. Yeah, okay, yeah.
And so that's also the opportunity to get Oda. He has been requisitioned to help Goto drive this Pat Labor truck, and he is annoyed that he was called up on vacation. But this is kind of like where I give him a bit more credit is he's doing it. He's still part of the team. He's willing to come in on vacation. This is important. And also like he needed someone he could trust. Goto trusts him. Mm-hmm. So I got to trust him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Meanwhile, back in Hokkaido, Asuma is drinking with Noah and her dad and being a dick to Noah. And the news breaks that a military labor broke through a checkpoint on the highway.
Yes.
And there's a bit of debate about what's going on, but they very quickly come to the conclusion that a piece of military hardware that serious could not be hijacked and used by terrorists.
Right.
Because they acknowledge, as mech pilots, it takes an incredible amount of maintenance infrastructure to keep these things running.
Right.
So they believe that the people piloting them are the people who they were issued to.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I was a little confused here. This is actually when we go back to Goto and Clancy. Right?
Yes. My bad. Yes.
Yeah. No.
Okay. Because, yeah, I guess you just hear about this on the news in the background with Noah and Azuma. Right. And I did actually kind of, as much as he's being a jerk, I did kind of enjoy that like their arguing annoys her dad so much that he's like, I'm going to bed.
I don't know. It's like, it gave off kind of like a bickering couple kind of vibe.
Right.
And I'm like, just looking at them both and I'm just like, I'm going to bed.
It is really funny to see him immediately get his wish of seeing his daughter paired off with a guy. And then he sees what it would look like. And he's like, I'm out.
I don't want this anymore. I don't really want this anymore.
But yeah, this Goto, is it?
It's Nagumo, I believe. He goes to visit
Nagumo. That's right.
Yeah, it's Nagumo, and then Goto. Like Goto calls Nagumo's house, her family house, and has a car parked like outside of her house. And the reason why is because he was concerned that his phone was tapped. It could have been tapped, right?
It's so sick. I like this kind of spy stuff, and I like the fact that they have to get in a car, and it's again a very unassuming scene. Like it'd be the camera is shot from like the back, and he's just like
very Coen Brothers sort of backseat, locked down camera in the backseat as the two of them talk with their faces forward.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where he just starts laying out the theory of like it doesn't make sense for terrorists to take such a complicated weapon that requires maintenance, requires tons of ammo. If it was just terrorists, they would have just taken a missile or a bomb.
Right.
And it's like, damn, I didn't consider that. That's a good point.
That's why Goda is the goat.
And then their last two lines, I think, when she's kind of starting to catch on to what he's putting out. And like, this is something where I don't think we can trust the government. It was like he's vague about who we can't trust, but it's like, I trust you. And so I need you to do something for me. And we don't get the plan, but we just hear him say like, I'm sorry, this is Goto. I'm sorry, you might be the one to end up taking a fall for all this. And then she says, I never could count on the second unit in the first place.
Oh, man.
So good.
And then gotta get one in before I get out.
Right. It's snowing.
It begins to snow and it is beautiful and the soundtrack is gorgeous. It's just a really it makes it feel like a really important moment, whatever has just happened.
Mm-hmm. And it also, I think, makes clear how much these two characters are like. You can make an assumption that, like, are they trying to have some, like, romantic tension? Are they either going to couple up or something? But it just seems to be like they have an incredible professional relationship going back years. And that's why he can trust her on this.
I feel like Goda, like, the reason why Goda stayed behind is not because he was bored. I think that he sort of had an inkling that some shit was going down. Mm-hmm. And also, he was concerned about Nagumo. And in the past, like, we've had, like, a brief instance where I think that, like, Goda has unconsciously let on that he does have feelings for Nagumo. So I think that's sort of, like, the combination of those two is, like, there's some fuckery afoot and, like, Nagumo might be in danger. So I think that's why he stayed back, yeah.
And to touch on it again really quickly, to go back to the idea of, like, the thing that he says, like, this isn't just some rocket launcher or a bomb. This is a full mech. I love that the show is staying committed to the idea that these mecha are not magic robots, right? They're not. Like, because in the first episode, or the second episode, I don't remember, when you see the hijacked labor. Again, the thing that brings that labor's rampage to an end is that it is being piloted by people who don't necessarily know how to use and maintain it, and it runs out of fuel before it can do anything else. Like, there are no magic bullets in this world, and it's like that makes this moment hit so much harder when you realize that, like, oh, wow, this is huge. The fact that they have access to a labor is huge. And
know how to use it.
Yes.
Like, already. Right. All right, and so things immediately escalate from there.
This next sequence kicks ass.
Yeah. Yes. I guess we get like an establishing shot of the snowy city. It's just like a little breath, and then the next morning, subway station.
Yes.
4:05 a.m. We've got the subway safety guy. We don't have these guys in the United States.
No.
Yeah, he's not a cop. He's more like a station manager.
Like a train station attendant or something like that. Just like
you know, see the viral videos of them like shoving people into the trains to get them moving and stuff.
right.
And he's doing this thing which I presume is he's on a completely empty platform, but he's still going. It's 4:05 a.m. He's still going through the motions of he points down the tunnel at where the next train is coming from to let people know that it's coming. But then it is not a train that comes down the tunnel. It's a column of tanks.
Lord, yeah, shit's getting real.
We start getting helicopters. They're unloading people on top of buildings. There are we see the military mechs. There's more than one. Military labors.
Right,
and we see a little bit of resistance. Metro Unit 1 has got their labors, and how did they do this? Well, when they were trying to grab everything in the city, one of the places, whoever these G-men are, they went to SV2. Or they went to the, I guess it's actually both kind of bases are in the same place. But they go there and they open the doors and they find one labor there. And like all the like mechanics from the second unit.
Yeah.
And they're kind of like, what's going on here? Where is everything? And like one of the guys like runs in, is like, we just checked for, like, nothing is here from the SV1.
We've been watching them all like all this time, like, where could they have done it? And I'm just like, oh, you ship them on a boat to the opposite end of like a lake or something like that. And Sakaki doesn't say anything. He's just like, he's kind of got this like a little bit of a shit-eating grin. He's like old man like face, but a slight shit-eating grin where it's just like, Maybe.
So something is going a little awry for whoever these people are that are trying to pull this off. And specifically the team is the first unit has taken up like a defense around, I think it's like City Hall. They're trying to like protect the city government.
It's sort of a counter-strike, actually. It's a counterplay. So they have, so the whatever faction this is that's doing pulling off this coup has people outside the SV2 base. They have people outside the National Diet, and they mention a couple of other federal buildings. This unit of police labors, PAT labors, is outside the HQ of the military.
Ah. That's okay. That makes more sense because we get that like kind of quick, like literally the shadowy figure scene where a bunch of guys mm-hmm. who's in silhouette, they all have similar like, you know, gruff voices. And they're just talking about, okay, like we have control of all five major sections of the city except yeah. for one.
And then one guy leans forward into the light with his face, with his body still obscured or whatever, and he's just like, Goda. Just like he knows.
And that was the guy in the ramen?
I believe so,
I think yeah. that was the guy in the ramen place? Shop okay. who yeah. was just staring down Asuma, and like, it was, it's so fascinating to think that Goda has nemeses in the fucking military. That's incredible. Yeah. We There's, know this yeah. guy, yeah.
So at this point, yeah, we know that they have some sort of connection. But Nagumo is there in front of the military HQ with what looks like three old model pat labors. These would be yep. specifically the ones that were adapted from true labor units into police labors. They're not the new high-tech ones. Those right. are – one of those, I believe, is – at least one of those is not spoken for right now. We don't know where it is.
Yeah.
And she says – if blood is spilled here, Japan's 30,000 officers will see you as the enemy and fight you to the last man.
Because it's clear what we know about the show. It's likely the new like pat labors that this unit has would have a hard time up against these military ones. These old units are going to stand no chance.
Right.
So they are the implication here is literally that they are bodies standing in the way and right. that they right. won't take them out because of the risk of a fallout
of a domestic political like incident, like a major like controversy.
We also start seeing the team assembling.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
So you know, we have our wife guy leaving. We have Oda. He's getting ready, yep. and then someone who we haven't seen this whole episode.
I love yeah. this scene. Yes, it's
Yamazaki.
It's Yamazaki, and he's just like, he's at the family house, and he's paying his respects to his dad who passed away, and we see a picture of his dad. He's the spitting image of his dad, and it's just like, just looks older, and it's just like, it really pulls on your heartstrings, goes outside. His mom is just like, you pay respects to your father? Like, yeah, and it's just like, don't miss your bus or whatever and stuff like that. And he's like, he stops. He's about to say something to his mom, and his mom reprimands him, and he's like, get going, and just like, you're going to be here next summer or whatever, and it's just like,
he tears up a little bit.
I'm like, man, the things you didn't say, like, what did he want to say? Like, come on, man. Like, yeah.
Yeah, the air of destiny is hanging heavy at the end of this episode.
Yes.
God, I've now realized for the first time someone could die on this show.
Oh, know, right? My God.
And it's yeah. like, I don't know, there's something, having lived through recent history, there is something so right about the way they pull this off, because it's like, this stuff is happening not in the immediacy of the standoff mm-hmm. At military HQ, because this is the next morning, right? This is early mm-hmm. that morning. So it's like hours have passed. So you are in this moment dealing with the feeling that these characters have, where it's like, this is going on right now. And it's mm-hmm. been going on for a while. And we do not know when we're going to be through this.
Right. And moreover, they haven't, to my knowledge, they haven't even communicated to one another. They just
yeah,
know
right,
there
right.
is some shit going down in Tokyo, and whatever mm-hmm. is going down there, I need to be there. And every one of them is just like, I need to be there.
Because we actually do get, specifically, Noah and Azuma, like, do see this on TV. And they mm-hmm. see SV-1 there. And mm-hmm. that's kind of what cues them. Like, okay, if SV-1's there, we got to be there. Specifically, right. though, Noah says, this will ruin the reputation of labor units.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just so like, funny. That's her immediate thought. Is like, she's so single-minded. She is like the most yeah. shonen protagonist out of all of these people in terms of like, yeah. she's singularly focused
it's
on
like
one
robots,
thing.
Yeah. Labors. Like,
yeah. And then the narration says, we see Shinohara and Noah on their way to Tokyo. And the narration says, a war was waiting for us in Tokyo. Boy, what an ep.
Yeah.
What a fucking ep.
What a cliffhanger. What a banger of a cliffhanger. I love that.
It really does have the intensity of and like I mean, it has the intensity of a movie. Like, this is, again, making me more and more excited for the movies that are going to come up after these, this OVA wraps up. But it is clear how much this show can stand on just its writing and story. When I think about shows that, big robot shows especially, like, they're relying so much on the cool robot, the action sequence that you get. And I expected that to be good in this show because it's so legendary, but it really is a show that can stand on its own when it comes to the writing, when it comes to the characters, having depth. Like, even for an OVA, you could think that, like, there's not going to be a lot of time here to get into it, and they're able to do such, like, compact yet incredibly illustrative little bits of storytelling that it's, I don't know, I just don't think it can fail. Like, I'm so excited for the part two of this.
Yeah, it's... The show is such a banger. It is at once not a deconstruction, but sort of like a counterpoint to popular giant robot anime. It really is leaning into the real behind real mecha. It's not sort of like positing it as sort of like a military drama in the milieu of like Mobile Suit Gundam or even like Macross or anything like that. It's emphasizing real mecha, as in, what if these mecha were in, not just in real world, but in our world, in the world contemporaneous to when it released, and what would the entire structure of society have to look like in order to substantiate that? It's a fantasy. It's a speculative fantasy about like mecha realism. It is a workplace comedy, and it is a military crime like drama, procedural drama on some level. It's so good. It's so good.
It was like a tiny detail, but like when they mentioned that this military labor has a Gatling gun, they say, "Oh, that's a like 90 MXQ. That's a NATO thing." The fact that like NATO exists in this world. Like, this is a world where on the other side of the planet, there are political organizations dealing with their own stuff. Like, that to me is what kind of helps to ground it, even though what we're talking about is a Gatling gun for a giant robot. Like, it seems to take pains to never stop thinking about that, which is how it can still keep me invested when it does have an episode with a giant kaiju. I still think that was real.
I think that was just like one fluke. They have one fluke. Like, give us a Godzilla episode, and then we'll return to like the weird workplace
after
hijinks.
The ghost story episode.
After the ghost, yeah, they always have one. It's like it always comes back to somehow some reality to it. Like,
well, this was a moment where I don't know if I was projecting, but it felt. Very much. It felt to me like this might be Oshii's politics coming into play a little bit here.
Yeah.
Because what we are seeing in this moment is a cruel irony of, okay, so Limpak, these military exercises happening out in the ocean. This is a thing that if you read between the lines, the real purpose of military maneuvers, practices a lot of times is a show of force, right? Mm-hmm. It is the place that you are doing these things is usually like, you know, somewhere close to one of the other world powers that you're trying to keep in check. And you're saying, look at all this shit that we have and how organized it is.
Yeah.
So you have this force that is called the Japanese Self-Defense Force, and it, by participating in these maneuvers as a show of force, puts itself in a position where it cannot defend Japan.
Yeah.
And again, that is in cooperation and collaboration with the United States. They are, their self-defense force is baited out of Japan by this participation in this larger empire sort of exercise. So I don't know, like, how much of that is me projecting onto Oshii?
I think that is exactly on point. Like, it touches on. Here's a fun fact. A fun fact that I wanted to share about this episode, because I did do a little bit of research, and I realized that the premise of Pat Labor 2 was originally inspired by this two-parter. They were originally going to just do. This, they're going to do like a feature length version of this, like, two-parter, But then they decided to do some other sort of like tweaks to it. So like this two-parter, SV2's Longest Day, is sort of the spiritual precursor to what will eventually come about in Pat Labor too. So I feel like this is definitely a reflection of his politics to an extent. Yeah.
Yeah. That one is, that I'd heard is that one's very political and that it has a lot of these kind of like elements of political thriller and military intrigue that, yeah, I was, that makes me more excited for that one too.
Yeah. Criticism of domestic like defense forces and of empire. Like, yeah.
Sorry, this is like the last thing because I don't think it came up too much in this. This is sort of a prediction I have for the part two because it was here. And that is Shinohara making these military things. I just have to wonder how innocent they are in all of this.
Yes.
Because I'm wondering what else the like, or if there's some kind of like partnership between them with whatever faction of this military is that decided to pull this off, that they're also the part that appreciates that Shinohara is making it giant death machines and it would like to use those to patrol the streets of Tokyo. Just because some of the stuff it mentioned in the beginning about how like, well, we don't have a market to sell construction ones and the police don't buy nearly enough of them, so we got to go to the next. And it's like, well, if the military isn't asking for enough, you might have to make them or find a reason for it. And so I just cannot help but think that maybe a military industrial complex might also be pulling the strings.
Oh, man. Yeah, I feel, yeah, that's a thread. That's a thread to pull on. Oh, my God. I can't wait for this next episode.
Specifically makes me wonder, was that why Daddy wanted him in the police force?
Oh, my God.
Okay. An unassuming inside man?
We got to see where this leads. Like, oh, man, I can't wait. I can't wait for the next episode.
Yeah. So for our labor stuff today.
Labor time.
I started thinking about coups, military stuff, military industrial complex,
as one does.
Thinking about successful coups, who throws them, who repels them. This show has a certain sort of civic optimism, I would call it, where the Japanese police force, in this case, sets themselves as the opposition to this thing happening. We don't yet know whether this is who within the JSDF has launched this coup, whether this is a rogue faction, whether this is an intentional act by the central JSDF. I think we're leaning towards the rogue faction sort of thing.
Sorry, I think we mentioned it. They did show a guy's face at one point and just said, like, this is the leader of
Rogues. Something Kuriyama Kiyoto or something
like
that.
But we don't know him. I think a character might have recognized him, but it's definitely the setup for the next episode.
Yeah.
But it made me think of the Bonus Army. Are you familiar with the Bonus Army?
No.
Yes. I do because I helped a little bit on a video. You mentioned this one.
That's right. So yeah, this is, I'm going to read you a bit here from a book called The Gangsters of Capitalism. You cool if I just read a couple pages of book
yes,
here?
Yes, please. Please okay do.
So the Bonus Army, the summary of it was that, you know, I'll just read and then I'll say anything that the book doesn't say. Over the spring of 1932, veterans from every corner of the country began making their way to the capital. They stowed away in boxcars, hitched rides on trucks, and followed Joe Angelo's example and walked. They called themselves the Bonus Expeditionary Force, and they set up encampments, or Hoovervilles, in the parlance of the time, across Washington. By July, there were some 45,000 veteran protesters, wives, and children living in shacks and tents in the shadow of the Capitol Dome. So the Bonus Expeditionary Force, which also became known as the Bonus Marchers and the Bonus Army, was, there they are.
Oh, wow. That's where
visual medium.
If you're watching this through the video version, you can actually see a picture being held up by Clayton about the Bonus
Most
Army.
Lo-fi way
but
to
you'll
do
have
it,
to
right?
pay. You'll have to pay extra in order to get that.
It was big. It was a lot of people.
Yes, and they were a massive encampment of World War I veterans who had been promised a bonus to be paid for them for their service at some point between 1925 and no later than 1945. Mm. It's 1932. The Great Depression has been kicking their asses,
right,
and they want their money now. Because otherwise, because it's not going to be good for them in 1945. They need it now. So they've set up camp to demand payment before 1945.
Right.
It's like on the lawn, like right in front of the Capitol building, basically.
Yeah, right in front of the Capitol. To jump ahead a little paragraph here. But the federal and military establishments were not pleased. They denounced the occupiers as communists and radicals. Most alarming to some, veterans of all skin colors were living in the bonus camps side by side at the time when both the District of Columbia and military were strictly segregated by race. The bonus marchers successfully pressured the House into approving a bill sponsored by Wright Patman, the Democrat from Texas, that would have provided the immediate cash payment of $2.4 billion, which is $46 billion today, to be distributed among all certificate-holding veterans. But on July 16th, the Senate adjourned without taking it up, effectively killing the measure. Senators left just before midnight, fleeing through the underground tunnels beneath the Capitol to avoid confronting marchers. Hoover headed to Shenandoah for his summer retreat. So this pissed off the bonus marchers, obviously.
Yeah.
They didn't like that. And this is where a new character enters, which is Smedley Butler. Mm-hmm. Smedley Butler is a guy who has a complicated role in the, what I call the Hall of Crazy Ass White Boys.
Right next to John Brown.
Yes. And John Brown is the contrast to him that I've been thinking of recently.
Yeah.
Because John Brown, right, is this revolutionary figure who stands up for the right thing at the right time. Mm-hmm. But John Brown has been described by his contemporaries as a man who did not have racism in him, right? He is so pure in what he believes and how he lived. In contrast to Smedley Butler, who for the first half of his life was maybe the most evil man he possibly could have been in service mm-hmm. of the United States of America and, in his own words, the money men of Wall Street.
Mm. He was a useful sociopath.
Yeah. Oh, but he found some sort of conscience later. Okay. He's a confusing guy.
Yeah.
He lied about his age to sign up for the Spanish-American War, and he went to fight the war. He joined the Marine Corps and became a very, very decorated soldier. And then he served in every adventurous American deployment between like 1900 and 1930, right? So he was in the Philippines. He was in Nicaragua. Mm-hmm. He was in China. He was in Mexico. Anywhere U.S. interests were worried about their money and investments, he showed up to crush rebels.
Wherever, like, foreign minorities were getting out of line with the American Empire, he was there like a racist Captain America.
And he did, like, this episode of the show felt quite a bit like an instant example of boomerang theory, right?
Oh, yes, the Imperial Boomerang. Yes, the absolutely. Imperial
Boomerang, the idea that technology developed, technology and techniques developed for colonial war will come back and punish the home. You will end up being treated the way we treat people overseas. Mm. And this episode is an instant version of that, where the instant they develop this military hardware, it is being deployed against them.
Yep.
Anyways, long story short, he has some life experiences and he starts to become very, very aware of the role that he played in simply enriching rich Americans in this military adventurism. And he becomes an extremely, extremely outspoken anti-war speaker.
Politician. He's developing class consciousness.
So that is the interesting thing about Smedley Butler, again, in this thing that I refer to as the Hall of Crazy Ass White Boys, where his pure thing in his brain is class, right? Class mm-hmm. for him is like, he put all of his points at this point in his life into class awareness. And softened maybe a little bit on racial stuff, but still was very paternalistic.
I imagine this is like Fallout. It's like the special meter where you have to like put your different points, and halfway through his life, he just respect and put all of his points into class consciousness.
Yeah. So to jump around here, he shows up at the bonus army. He gives some rousing speeches. Says, "By God, they didn't speak of you as tramps in 1917 and 18, he said to applause. "I mean just what I say. I don't want anything." He assured them, his tie now loose and his arms flying wildly through the air, "Nobody can kick me anymore. I'll say what I please." So this is sort of him at the transition point of like, this is what he's going to spend the rest of his life doing, is standing up for human beings who have been used as ammunition. In the next couple days, General MacArthur, relevant to Japan. You know, this might not even be that MacArthur. This might be his dad.
Wow.
Hang on. Let me look into that. Anyways, I'm not going to look into that now. MacArthur orders that the standing army go take care of the former army. They start raiding and forcefully clearing the encampment. They're throwing tear gas. They are firing weapons at some points. Some people die. A baby who had been living with a family there in the encampment is killed by the tear gas. And this is a big moment for FDR, who is moved by what happens here and uses the action that is taken to the bonus army to start building his platform towards his presidency and the New Deal and correcting what he sees as this injustice. And again, FDR, again, is a complicated figure because he did serve alongside Butler in some of the places that Butler was off doing awful things. Anyways, this has all been a very long walk through some military history.
But a fascinating walk.
Mm-hmm. Yes. To the topic of coups, eventually we get to 1934, and we have this headline here from the New York Post. "General Butler accuses New York brokers of plotting dictatorship in U.S. $3 million bid for fascist army bared. He says he was asked to leave $500,000 for a capital putsch. U.S. probing charge." So Butler says that he was in the time following the bonus army. He was approached by a group of American industrialists who saw what was going on overseas in Germany and Italy and saw that it was very good for business over there and thought that it might be good for business here. The Nazis had looked elsewhere in the United States for inspiration as well, studying American eugenicists like Madison Grant and Lothrop Stoddard and writing racial codes based in part on America's own system of legalistic racial authoritarianism, Jim Crow. Pre-Nazi German scholars had praised the system of Schutzenberger's Weiter Klaus, a second-class citizenship that the United States had foisted upon Filipinos, Puerto Ricans, and other in its formerly annexed territories. The word Nazis used to justify their planned colonization of Eastern Europe, Lebensraum, or living space, was an analog to Frederick Jackson Turner's free land, coined by Turner's German colleague and mutual admirer Friedrich Ratzel. Hitler had approvingly noted that white settlers in the U.S. Army had gunned down the millions of... I'm going to say an antiquated word here.
Okay.
Hitler had approvingly noted that white settlers and U.S. Army had gunned down millions of Redskins to a few hundred thousand, and now keep a modest remnant under observation in a cage. In 1933, Nazis put those words into action by opening their first concentration camp at Dachau, modeled on the form pioneered by the Spanish in Cuba, the British in South Africa, and the United States in the Philippines. It would take 8 years of growth and war before Nazi camps took on their final exterminationist form. Mm. These resemblances were no surprise. Germany and the United States were in many ways sister empires, who had risen at roughly the same time. Mm-hmm. To challenge the older powers of Europe, it was for... I'm bad at reading.
I wish I could come over there and help you. I'm just like, no, I can do this. Yeah, I read. I was one of those kids who read in class all the time. I can totally do this. Yeah.
To jump ahead very briefly again, the question for all Americans in the 1930s was if they would do the same. MacArthur's answer in the burning of the bonus camp seemed in Roosevelt's eyes to be a resounding yes. Roosevelt, despite his similar background and experience, chose otherwise. He resolved to show that democracy in the United States, limited and flawed though it remained, was better than abandoned in the hope of strengthening and extending it, as the historian Eric Rockway has written. Roosevelt would do so by remaking his relationship between the government, business, and the people through his New Deal. His program as president would include massive spending on public works, social insurance against old age, unemployment and disability, and support for labor unions. With his good neighbor policy for Latin America, he would reshape, if symbolically, some of the old imperial arrangements he had helped foster. As Rockway wrote, the New Deal would show ordinary Americans that their government could work for them, albeit imperfectly. So I think that's one of the important things to take away from. This is all so much stuff and it's so big. But one, I think for the purpose of Pat Labor.
Yeah.
Fantastic book. This is by Jonathan M. Katz. Incredible read. But I think the important thing for the purpose of Pat Labor is that last part there about the New Deal and the government working for people is this sort of civic optimism that I mentioned earlier that this show has about the idea that a public service such as the police could be good, right? In this world, in this particular world, this force as a separate force from the military offers a counterbalance to this other power.
Checks and balances, if you will.
Right.
Checks and balances, which is so depressingly different from our reality where you see the police working, doing all of their own evil stuff, but then being completely subservient to the military and the federal government the moment they're told to, right? There is no resistance within that organization to this greater power.
Yeah.
And we also see, I think, in it being a real robot show, it's also like a... This vision of the Metropolitan Police as a professional force that is doing training constantly, that is very regulated as far as what weapons and arms it can use, and it has like very strict, like, we're not here to be a military force against like the people in the city. It is actually our job to protect them from Pat Labor's, but also kaiju. Like it's
right.
It loses the thread a little bit, but like it is. At a core, as much as it does do some of that critiquing of the police, it does have, like you said, an optimism about what their role in society should be, which is a vanguard of the democratically elected government, and it takes orders from those people. It works for those people. And that is, at least at the end of this episode, maybe still the case in this world.
That's the idea.
Hope to see part two.
Yeah. It reminds me a lot of another anime series, which was Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood. The same sort of optimism about people within evil systems being willing to rebel against them. And I feel like it's not a thing that I see quite as often in American media, but like it's an optimism because I think it you know, it'd be unfounded and extremely unrealistic and hard to buy.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
But yeah, I was just thinking about how throughout, you know, Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood, like when people learn that this system that they're in is evil, how many of them are willing to be like, okay, yeah, I'll commit treason in that case. Like,
yeah. Well, they learn about the true motivations behind the Ishvalan, the war against the Ishvalans, and like what all of that was actually really about. And I'm just like, yeah, just not feeling too great about being a state alchemist right now. I was just like, yeah.
And yet at this point, I think I still feel okay about
SB2.
Yeah, still met SB1. I guess now they finally got their moment in the sun to be like, we'll put our bodies on the line here. Mm-hmm. But
yeah.
Well, cool. This has been, I'm sorry, Pat, did you have anything else to go in?
No, that's it. I don't have any good conclusions. I just have some stuff that made me think of, and I'm sorry that you're going to have to edit that down and find what's actually useful.
I always like to talk about the business plot.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Go read more about that. Go read that book. It is fascinating. And perhaps the closest we've come so far to a coup in America.
Yes.
This has been another episode of Pat Labor, a production of Rogue.site. Once again, we really appreciate everyone out there who's subscribing. They're getting access to the bonus video podcasts. And, I think if we can find the time here, we might do a little reflection on this first OVA here in the next couple weeks. But regardless, we appreciate you being a part of this worker-owned, reader-supported website and podcasts. So yeah, we'll see you next time, unless you're staying tuned for the video podcast. I am Clayton Ashley.
I am Tucson Eakin.
And I'm Patrick Gill.
Toodles.
Bye. Bye.